Hi, everyone. I'm Erin Schaefer. I'm a GA over at the Women's Center. I'd like to welcome you to our Women on Wednesday series, Education, Advocacy, and Empowerment, celebrating 20 years. A few items before we get started. Please turn off cell phones and pagers, and please remain in your seat until 12:50 as a courtesy to our speaker. Also, if you could please fill out the orange evaluation sheet, we use this for future programming. Our session today is titled Life After an Eating Disorder. Today's talk will cover some of the misconceptions about eating disorders as lifelong incurable diseases. Our presenter will share some of her inspiring story of her struggle and recovery from an eating disorder. She will also discuss the signs and symptoms of eating disorders, goals of treatment, and ways to support family members of those struggling with eating disorders. Our speaker today is Lee Bloom. Lee Bloom is a health educator as well as a speaker and writer at Park Nicollet Melrose Institute of Eating Disorders in St. Louis Park, Minnesota. She works daily with patients in all levels of the Melrose Institute's program and runs a support group for family and friends of those struggling with eating disorders. After almost losing her life to an eating disorder in depression 14 years ago, Bloom has made it her mission to share her story of hope and recovery so others can find life on the other side of an eating disorder. We are very, very grateful to have her here with us today. Please join the Women's Center in welcoming Lee Bloom.
I have all my stuff on the floor. Thank you for having me. I think I'm going to pull this out so I can walk around. We have not an hour, so I will try and be really good with the time. And she's going to hold up a little flag, hopefully, so I can stay on track. Today, like she mentioned, I am going to talk a little bit about my own journey, and hopefully you'll walk out of here having learned something different about eating disorders, having learned really what eating disorders are, how they happen, and what recovery looks like. And I hope out of everything, you walk out of here with a little bit of hope. So I'm first going to start by sharing my own story. And I like to talk about my story in terms of tornadoes. That being because I grew up in Kansas. And if you're a college basketball fan, the KU Jayhawks are ranked number one, which is awesome. So I grew up in Kansas, and most of my early childhood was fun and exciting until my first tornado hit. The first tornado in my life hit when I was 12 years old, and just like a lot of families, my parents ended up getting a divorce. At that time in my life, at 12 years old, I somehow got this message, and nobody was giving me this message. It's only now, as I've grown older, that I realize this. But I got a message that I needed to be better. That I somehow needed to do better, that I somehow, if I was better, then maybe my parents wouldn't get a divorce. If I was better, then maybe they wouldn't have fought so much. So that what started then at a very early age was a real strive for perfectionism. The interesting thing that why I'm describing this is that perfectionism, for a lot of people, doesn't come from external sources. For some it does, but for me it really wasn't coming from an external source. It was more of an internal feeling that I had, a constant strive for needing to be better and better. And that's a key piece as I continue on in my story. The next piece of the story is that I grew up very small. And for me, being small, I hated it. I absolutely despised being little. People would nickname me Little Lee and Pee Wee Lee and Flea, and I hated it. And I think it's one of those things, like, if you have straight hair, you want curly hair. If you have curly hair, you want straight hair, kind of one of those things, right? So I was little, and I wanted to be big. I wanted to be tall. I wanted to be take up space. And so I even remember, laying in bed at night and saying, oh God, please, please just bring me long hair and big boobs. You know, and every night that was my prayer. Please just bring me long hair, make me taller, and give me big boobs, because that somehow was going to solve the problem. And I tell you that because being little also transferred when I went off to college. When I went off to college, another tornado in my life hit. And that tornado was that my body didn't start really doing the changes that it needed to until I got to college. And for most women, it happens at an earlier age. But for me, it was happening in the midst of changing schools. But I just remember that I forgot to play my video, so I'm going to go back. When I was in high school, remember I was saying that there was this overwhelming need to achieve. And when I got into high school, I found that that success piece really filled up my love tank. I loved being the best at everything, and it was kind of my own striving that got me there. And so I'm going to play a little video for you of giving my graduation speech when I graduated from high school, if he can play it. And you really got to check out the Aquanet hair.
Evening will be given by Ms. Catherine Lee Wolf, daughter of Mr. Michael P. Wolf and Mrs. Terry Parasak. Lee was president of Student Congress this year and served as secretary to STUCO last year. She was vice president of the Thespian Executive Board and has performed in 14 drama productions and had the principal lead role in many of them. Lee has the distinction of receiving the Cochrane Thespian Award, a prestigious award for acting excellence. She also participated in the varsity drill team. Lee will attend Southwest Missouri State University in Springfield, Missouri, and she invites her classmates to fly.
Life is like an onion. You peel one layer at a time. Our sweaty palms gripped the rigid dowels as we turned them, excited to open the...
How about those bangs? Those nice? That little pancake wall? I show you that. You can turn it off. I show you that because I remember at that moment just thinking, bring it on, world. You know, my goal was to be on Broadway. I was really into theater. That was my goal. I was going to New York. I was going to be on Broadway. There was no question about it. The thing about life is it always throws you lovely little curveballs, doesn't it? So I get to college, like I was saying before, I get to college and my body started really doing its changes that it should have done in junior high or high school when I got to college. Now you combine that with the overwhelming experience of being a freshman in college, along with this girl that you just saw that was pretty self-centered and thinking that I could do anything. And what was really starting to happen to me was I was starting to experience some overwhelming hormonal changes, some overwhelming things that were way out of my control, which was my body doing things that I didn't understand. If I were to have the same thing happen to me now, it would be depression. What I was experiencing was really early signs of depression, but this was a while ago, and they didn't have the things that they have now to really talk about depression and to diagnose depression. So here I was, and this is my third tornado that I like to say happened along the process, and that's the tornado just of being in college. And for some it sounds, well, that's so silly, being in college is so simple, but the reality is that eating disorders, the prevalence of eating disorders in college-aged women is astronomically huge. You get to college, sometimes you don't know how to eat, you're overwhelmed, it's hard to take care of your body, and all those things were happening to me. And then I came home from college my freshman year, and my dad was having a party, and I hadn't seen him because I was away at college, and I walked in, and my dad looked at me, and he said, "Oh, look who's gained the freshman 15. And that just ripped my heart out. Now, my dad didn't mean to hurt my feelings. I think what he had wanted to say is, my little girl has become a woman. But that would be awkward to say. So he said, "Look who's gained the freshman 15. I took that as, I need to be better. I took that as, I need to do better, I need to be better, and hey, I can do it. It was this very continuous pattern in my life of self-achieving. So I just went back to school and decided to start exercising. Because I hadn't really done any big exercise things before. And back then it was Jane Fonda aerobics, you know, so I put my leg warmers on, I go to aerobics class, I do this stuff. And And that's fine in moderation. The problem was, is that, and this is that I didn't know this about myself, the problem was I couldn't do anything in moderation. I mean, if you heard her talking about me, it's like, wow, that's really cool. But the reality as I look back is, no, that's somebody who couldn't do anything in moderation. Everything had to be more. Everything had to be a little bit better. And I never really start, as I grew older, I started to not feel a sense of fulfillment, even from being the best at something. It was just never enough. Now, I mentioned this part about starting to exercise and starting to watch what I was eating. And a confusing piece of the puzzle was that I grew up with a mom who was always on a diet. My mom would sit down at meals and she would be having Slim Fast, or she'd be just eating rice, or other times she just wouldn't be eating anything. So I didn't also, in college, have a sense of what normal eating was. I didn't understand what was a normal portion size because I had really never been taught. And I say that because I want you to know my mom didn't cause my eating disorder. But the habits of my mom definitely made it more difficult for me to take care of my body in a way that should have been intuitive. So we get to, I believe it was my sophomore year in college, and now I'm going to describe for you an analogy that hopefully makes you understand eating disorders. And the analogy goes like this, and it's a quote by a woman named Amy Liu, who wrote this book called Gaining. Genetics makes the gun, environment loads the gun, and an overwhelming set of emotional circumstances pulls the trigger. Okay, so you take me, genetically, and I didn't know this until I got to be older, genetically I was predisposed to addictive behavior. If you look at my family tree, there's addiction pretty much all throughout my family, whether it's alcoholism, smoking, other random addictions. Not to the point where things were falling apart in my family, but addictive behavior. So genetically, I was predisposed to addictive behavior. Now, it's not because of my family tree that I'm predisposed, but it's, if you start to look back at my personality, growing up, you could see that I was definitely had that behavior from an early onset of childhood. Does that mean I'm going to have an eating disorder? No, because somebody can be genetically predisposed to addictive behavior and never need to use the addiction, because an addiction is used to cope. So genetics makes the gun, environment loads the gun. Okay, you think about it, my environment, right? I'm in college, body image is kind of a huge thing. I was concerned about my body changing. I was concerned about maybe gaining the freshman 15. I was exercising, and then I had this ability to not be able to stop when I started things. So that all kind of makes for a lovely little mess, right, when you start to think about it. And then the last piece, what finally pulls the trigger, is an overwhelming set of emotional circumstances. So for me, I was just exercising and doing those things, but then we had a family crisis. We had 3 deaths within one family. I mean, within 1 year. We had 3 funerals to go to, and that, for me, pulled that trigger. I didn't know how to cope. I didn't know how to deal with my own emotions. I didn't have a set of coping skills except achievement and doing better. So I went straight to that, and it served me really well. And so I describe that because we see at a treatment center that a lot of people, that's how it happens. For some, it's a first grader and somebody calls them fat. They start watching what they eat and they can't stop, and the eating disorder is pulled. Does that make sense? For others, it's going to college. For some, it's having babies. For others, it's divorce. I mean, it's whatever, an overwhelming set of emotional circumstances that pulls that trigger. I explain that to you because I think a lot of times in our society, we have this idea that people are just choosing to do this. And the reality is nobody chooses an eating disorder. Granted, I could have possibly started drinking and gone off the deep end with drinking. I could have tried drugs and gone off the deep end of drugs. But for me, the addiction was the eating disorder. It became a way to cope. It became a way for me to numb out. I was so overwhelmed with emotions and hormonal changes and body changes and then not feeding myself appropriately that I didn't know what to do. And the only thing I felt like would work would be to numb out. And so I didn't eat. And then I couldn't stop not eating. And that's how an eating disorder happens. In the beginning of it, you don't realize what you're doing. So we go a few years down the road. The eating disorder now, it's like a love affair. We call it Ed at our treatment center, and a lot of books call it Ed as well. And what happens is you start to flirt with Ed. So my flirting with Ed was going to aerobics classes. It was trying different diets. And then you start to realize that Ed is going to bring you things. And so Ed started kind of bringing me this ability to numb out. And it also started bringing me a high. Now, for normal people who just stop eating, it doesn't bring you a high. But for somebody who's got a need for an addiction, it does bring some sort of sense of relief from the overwhelmingness of life. So I'm guessing you can probably assume what happened. I got very ill, and my parents intervened, and they sent me to a psychiatric unit. Now, back then, we didn't have treatment centers like we do now. And so they sent me to the psychiatric unit, and I remember getting there, and, you know, do you guys watch Intervention? You know how they sit in the little circle, and there's a therapist. And so it was exactly like that. And I'm sitting there looking around at these people and thinking, oh, I'm so not like these people. You know, this is a mistake. I shouldn't be here. And then I thought, but I can help these people. And so I made it my mission to help these people. And I kind of tagged myself as president of the Loony Bin, which sounds so crazy now that I think about it. But I really had this idea like, oh, I was just brought here. This is like my mission in life, so I could come and help these people. So I'd stay up late, and I'd counsel people, and I'd help them. And never did I have to deal with any of my issues. And it worked out really great. And the funny thing is, now working in the treatment center, I see patients doing this all the time. They come in, they care about everyone else, but they don't know how to take care of themselves. And so it's easier to just take care of everyone else. And that's another trait that really runs throughout people with eating disorders, is this desire and this care to help everyone else, but an inability to really recognize what's going on with themselves and to take care of themselves. So I got transferred from this loony bin, and no longer was the president of the loony bin, and got sent to an eating disorders facility. At the eating disorders facility, I started really working on my issues. I started learning new tools to cope. I started doing family therapy and talking about my issues. The problem is that I didn't want to give it up. And that's the thing with an addiction. You can lead a horse to water, but you cannot make them drink. So if you have friends or you have family that has an addiction or is using something negatively to cope, you continue to lead them to the water, but you have to remember that they have to want it. And that's the other piece that I really want you to know about an eating disorder, is that an eating disorder is not a choice, but recovery from an eating disorder is. And the only person who can make that choice is the person who's struggling. So as much as my family pushed, as much as I heard from doctors and heard from therapists and heard from everybody that I needed to stop this behavior, there was a part of me that needed it in my back pocket. There was a part of me that needed it just in case life got too hard. And that's the thing with an eating disorder, with alcoholism, with drug addiction, is you can't just keep it in your back pocket. Alcoholics, when they're in recovery, don't say, oh, I'm just going to have one drink. It's just, it doesn't work. And so the same is true with an eating disorder. For me, I needed to really give up the eating disorder. So I wasn't really ready. I got out of the treatment center. My depression spiraled out of control because I also had this refusal to take medication. I had this skewed idea in my head that medication only changed my personality. And I was a very creative person. I really loved theater, and I really loved using my creativity, and I felt like it would change me. So I wouldn't take meds. And within 3 months after leaving this treatment center, I spiraled into a very, very dark depression. And the thing about depression is that, you know, you hear about people who are in depression and they either take their life or they mess up their life, and you say, well, gosh, they had such great things going for them. But depression is like being in a dark, dark hole, and nothing anyone says or does is going to bring you out of it. It's a horrible place to be, and at that point in my life, I felt like it was never going to get better. And the sad thing is, though, is depression, the only way to get out of depression is to get through it. The only way to get out of a tunnel is to go through it. So I needed to go through it, but it felt so entrapping. I felt so holed up that I thought, I will never, ever get out of this. And then the other piece was that everyone kept telling me, nobody recovers from an eating disorder. That was kind of the general thought process around eating disorders. People don't recover from an eating disorder. My dad kept saying, you know, you're going to probably struggle with this the rest of your life. So here I am in this dark hole, and I'm like, great, I'm really excited to get better. I'm going to struggle with this the rest of my life. That's a lot of hope, right? But people, you hear people probably saying that. Somebody with an eating disorder is going to struggle for the rest of their life. At this point in my story, I just realized, you know, I'm done. This is just, I'm just not willing to continue down this road if every day is going to be a struggle, if eating food is going to be a struggle, if learning to love my body is going to be a struggle. And at that point, I got so ill that I ended up in the ICU on my deathbed. And I tell you that not as shock or sensationalizing an eating disorder. I tell you that because that was my rock bottom. And why I go and speak now is because I don't want anyone to get to that rock bottom. I don't want you, if you're sitting in this audience struggling with any sort of addiction, to have to go through what I went through. Because I got a second chance, but not everybody gets a second chance. In January, we lost 3 patients. Now, these weren't patients that were in our facility, but they had gone through our facility and they died of an eating disorder. So I'm telling you that because I want you to hear my message and hear that there's hope and know that if you're struggling with something like this, to get some help. At this point, I finally kind of had this light bulb moment, which whenever I hear my own story, I'm like, duh, like light bulb moment. You know, you've been in treatment, you've done all these things. You like, why is my light bulb moment coming in the ICU? But it did for me. And sometimes that's just how some of us work. And I was laying there and I thought, you know, I really have 2 choices. I can either continue to do what I'm doing, which is and expect a different result each time, which is the definition of insanity, to do the same thing over and over again and expect a different result each time. Or, novel idea, I could try something different. I could listen to the people that were telling me what to do as far as eating, as far as coping, as far as taking my meds. I could try that. But the difference was is I needed to try it without keeping the eating disorder in my back pocket. I needed to try it and give up the power, which is powerlessness. And there's a reason why AA has the 12 steps, because powerlessness is really the first step for anybody to recover from any sort of an addiction. I needed to fully admit, yeah, my life's out of control, and I really need to ask for help. But giving up that power also brought me back the control, because now I could control my recovery. I could put all the energy I put towards my eating disorder, doing the insanity, towards my recovery. And as I started doing that, I started realizing that life was worth living, that there was life on the other side of an eating disorder, that I could eat normally and function normally. And so I describe it like this. Every day we get up and we have choices. And every day you make a choice, especially when you're in the struggle of with an addiction. Every day you get a choice. Am I going to choose the addiction or am I going to choose life? And I promise you, choosing life was really, really hard for me in the beginning. So I'd get up and I'd be struggling. I'd call a friend. I'd get up or I'd eat breakfast and I'd be struggling. I would go somewhere in a public place. I'd be struggling again. I'd call my therapist. You know, whatever it took to get me through the day. And the more days that I chose recovery and the more days that I continued to fight, the less I desired the eating disorder. But the thing is in our culture, we always want a quick fix. And we think, a lot of times we think, oh, send them to treatment and they'll be better. But recovery is a journey, and it's a one step at a time journey. So my recovery was a slow process, and it took every day me giving up the power, saying, I need help. I have to ask for help. I can't do this on my own. And as I got longer in my journey, I started to be able to have the strength to start to do it on my own. But it's only through that one step at a time, one day at a time, really giving up the power that helped me. So What then happened? Well, I'd like to describe my recovery from an eating disorder and seven key things. So there were really seven things that helped me in my recovery from an eating disorder. The first I already described, and that was powerlessness. The second was going to a therapist. And a lot of times I think we get this idea that somebody just needs to eat. But remember, this is really nothing to do with food. Food is just what's used to cope or to take away the pain, okay? So I needed to go to a therapist and really get to the bottom of why I needed to cope. And I needed to learn new coping skills. I needed to fill up my toolbox with tools so that when life got too hard, I wasn't going to reach over here for Ed. So that's the second thing, is going to a therapist. And the other piece for me was going to a therapist and not BSing my way through therapy. When I was in treatment, I was really good at going to therapy and asking. I always had this little trick. I'd really get the therapist to talk about themselves, and then I'd never have to talk about myself. I'd walk out, and it worked grand, right? So I really needed to humble myself and go into therapy and really be real. But that helped me on my journey to recovery. So that's the second thing. The third thing, a dietitian, and I put them together, a dietitian and a psychiatrist. I needed to continue to go see a dietitian and a psychiatrist for a while. I needed the dietitian because I needed to learn how to re-eat. Remember I said I really didn't gain skills growing up on normal portion size. And you're not going to gain that skill also from just living in society, unfortunately, now, because portion sizes are so goofy, and you can pick up any magazine and it'll say eat this or eat that, you know, and it's so confusing. So imagine how much more confusing it was trying to recover. So I needed to go to the dietitian. I needed to be put on a meal plan. I needed to come back and see her and say, is this what I'm supposed to be eating for my body type? Is this what I'm supposed to be doing? And I also needed the consistency to believe in my own body. I needed the consistency of a weight that would stay consistent given 2 or 3 pounds, actually 3 to 5 pounds. For a woman, you know, our body weight should stay pretty consistent once you get to in your 20s and 30s. Within 3 to 5 pounds. And so I needed to see that my body was going to do what it needed to do, because I didn't believe it. And so by seeing a dietitian and being on a consistent meal plan and never skipping meals, I realized that my body was going to do what it needed to do. So it was really relearning that. And then the psychiatrist piece was I needed medication. And that was a really difficult thing for me to really come to terms with the fact that I needed medication. But now I look back, and now I've been on medication for 14 years, a very low dose of an antidepressant. But I look back and I think of how I feel now versus how I felt before the eating disorder. And I'm sad that I didn't get the medication earlier, because how much easier my life might have been. Because remember I described I had this kind of constant almost anxiety about achieving, about doing, and it was almost like an obsessive compulsiveness that I had. And now in the last 14 years, I found a much greater peace in my mind, and a lot of that is due to the medication. But medication in itself will not cure an eating disorder, but it is a component of it. So that was number 3, I believe. Number 4 was a support group. I needed a support group so I could go and talk to people who were in the same situation I was. The problem that we have with support groups is that a lot of times people will go to an eating disorder support group, and then they'll make that their community. That should not be your community, okay? If I want to be a swimmer, I'm not going to hang out with, you know, a track person, right? I mean, I might, but I'm not going to spend all my time with the track team. I'm going to hang out with the swimmers. We're going to talk about swimming. We're going to read about swimming. We're going to watch swimming on TV so I can learn about it. So if your goal is to be healthy, then you surround yourself with people who are healthy. A lot of times we have people who will get in these support groups, and that becomes their community, and then the eating disorder becomes their identity. And you don't want that. So if your goal is to be healthy, you're not going to surround yourself with a whole bunch of people who are really still struggling with eating and addictive behavior. But I needed that because I needed people who could talk the language. I needed to go and say, I'm really struggling with my meal plan, and they could say, I understand. This is what I've done. And then I needed to be away from that support group. And the number 5 part is community. Remember I said if I'm going to be healthy, then I needed to surround myself with healthy people. So I needed to be around people who were living life, who weren't talking about food and diet and body all the time. And that community is still a part of my life today. And sometimes that's difficult to find, but if you're intentional about it, you will be able to find it. So my girlfriends and I now, we don't sit around and talk about diets. We don't read Cosmopolitan. We have much, much deeper things to talk about than our bodies. And I love that. And they keep me grounded because they're not reaching for that ideal that isn't out there either. We're just living life and living it together. So that's community, of finding people who are living lives in a way that you want to live. And then the sixth thing is filling up my banana. What is that, you say? Well, I really think, I really like analogies because they help you kind of remember things. So an eating disorder, I describe it like a banana. The world, our society really focuses on the banana peel, right? I mean, you turn on any radio station and it's all about who looks like how and who's gained weight and who's lost weight and blah, 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 right? You pick up any magazine, People Magazine, is kind of the same thing. And then with an eating disorder, what happens to people is you put all the focus on the banana peel so that you don't have to pay attention to the banana, which is your soul. And so when I work with patients who have struggled with an eating disorder like 15, 20 years, they have no idea what they like anymore. They have no idea who they are on the inside anymore because they haven't paid attention to that banana, that soul on the inside. And the thing is when you go to a funeral and you see somebody has passed away, nobody sits around and talks about what they looked like, right? You don't sit around and talk about that. You talk about what they were like as a person, what they were like as a friend. You talk about the banana. So I encourage you, I know that's a cheesy analogy, but it works. So I encourage you, as you go through your day, check yourself. How much time am I focusing on the banana peel? And how much time am I focusing on the banana, the soul? So for me, in recovery, what I needed to do was I needed to start learning who I was on the inside. I needed to stop living my life for everyone else. I needed to stop people-pleasing and just really figure out who I was. And I found such freedom in that. I found such freedom in saying to somebody, you know what, I don't want to go to that. That's really just not something I'm interested in, you know, or this is the career I want and I'm going to follow this, not because my parents were telling me or society was telling me, but because I wanted to. And the more I started to fill up my soul, the more I started to find freedom from needing the eating disorder. And then the final thing is number 7, volunteering. I also volunteered for a high school youth group throughout my journey in recovery, and that was such a gift for me to be able to get outside myself and to go and help other people. The danger with people with eating disorders sometimes is that they help so much that they can't stop. Remember I was saying I tended to do things over and over again, or I tended to do things to the extreme. And so there was definitely that desire to always volunteer, to always be helping, to always be, you know, giving more and giving more. So I needed to learn to set boundaries in that area of my life, but I also found that volunteering really helped me do something bigger than myself, to do something outside of myself. And that's the 7th thing. So those are my 7 keys to recovering from an eating disorder. I want you to know that there's 7 keys because I think a lot of times we have this idea that it's just going to be a quick fix. They're just going to go to therapy and get better, or they're just going to take some antidepressants and get better, or they just need to start eating and get better. But that's not the reality. A lot of times in our society, we try and use rational thought towards something that's completely irrational, right? You see somebody and you say, well, just eat, right? And that's like the worst thing you could say to them. But your rational mind is saying, well, that's what they need to do. But it's an irrational disease. It is a disease, and they need professional help. So if you know somebody who's struggling with it, they need to get some professional help. It's not as simple as just eating. Now, when I talk about what life looks like, and I'm going to have enough time for question and answer. When I talk about what life looks like in recovery, I want you to know, remember I said earlier, I want you to understand that people do recover from an eating disorder. It is possible. People ask me all the time, parents will ask me, well, they're going to struggle with this for the rest of their lives, aren't they? And I'm like, no, recovery is possible. It's absolutely possible. And I describe it like this. I was born very fair-skinned, and I'm almost 38 years old, and I still somehow have this idea in my head that I'll get really tan. like I see somebody who's really tan, and I'm like, oh, I want to be that tan. So I'll like, you know, go lay out and put lots of stuff on. When I was in high school, we used to put baby oil on our skin, and then we'd lay on tinfoil and, you know, do all that. Okay, so I've been doing this for, you know, all these years, and yet I've never gotten tan. So you'd think I would radically accept the fact that I was not given bronze skin. But somehow in my head, I think, well, she has bronze skin. I can have bronze skin, right? But I will never have bronze skin. I even went to the extreme of my sister and I went on a cruise, and I thought, well, we'll be closer to the sun. You know, I can get tan. Okay, so I lay out, and what happens? By the end of the day, I am a tomato. And I am so sore and couldn't even really move my arms. And you'd think I'd learned my lesson. But I continue to look at other people and say, well, they get tan, why can't I? The same is true with us, especially us as women. Now, this affects men as well. But especially us as women, when we look at other women and we say, well, she's dieting, why can't I? Or she's working out for 2 hours, why can't I? And for me, I have to be very careful of that, and I call my recovery as wearing my sunblock. I cannot skip meals. Do I think skipping meals is going to lead me back to my eating disorder? No. But am I going to take that risk? No. So despite other people skipping meals, I can't skip meals. I have to wear my sunblock. I have to be protective of how much I exercise. I have to be protective of the things that I read, the things that I watch. Do I think that's going to send me back to my eating disorder? No, because I am so determined to never be back there again. But I'm going to do everything it takes to wear my sunblock. I have the tools in my toolbox to learn to cope with life, and that's my sunblock. So just as I need to always wear sunblock and know that I will never be tan, I also need to wear my sunblock in my recovery so that I don't fall into that again. So I don't go back to using addictive behavior to cope. The thing about that is you know, you get two girls in a family. I have a sister, and we grew up in the exact same family. We grew up very similar body types, but my sister didn't develop an eating disorder. And you ask that question, why? And the reason is you go back to that analogy that I gave you of the gun. You know, genetically, my sister does not have an addictive personality. She does not tend to go overboard with things. She grew up with the same mom. She grew up with the same type of things that happened. But for her, you know, she would go on a diet and she'd be able to stop. So that's why I can't look at somebody who's on a diet and say, well, I'm going to go on that diet because I'm not them. I won't be able to stop. And then where does that fall in my other areas of my life? Well, I have to wear my sunblock in my other areas of life because for me, I can get addicted to anything. I still have that addictive personality. I remember when the Twilight series came out, I started reading those books, and my sister kept saying, oh, you got to read those. They're so great. And I'm like, I'm not going to read vampire books. I started reading them. Next thing you know, I'm online looking up vampire stories. I want to watch every movie about vampire story. You know, something as simple as a silly vampire story, I could get addicted to. Facebook, I can get addicted to. But I have to be careful. I know myself and have to, you know, really watch myself in those areas. So she gave me the flag. So is that the five or the one?
Question and answer.
Okay. So I tell you this story, and I tell you all this because I hope you can learn from my story, that you can learn a couple of things. One, that an eating disorder is a disease. An eating disorder is not a choice. It becomes an addiction, it becomes a coping skill, and if somebody's struggling with it, they need to get professional help. I have lots of brochures back there for the Melrose Institute where I work, and you're welcome to take one. They have my email address if you ever want to email me and ask questions, more than happy to help you. But hear my story and know that there's hope. Know that people do recover. It has been 14 years, and I am here to tell you that I'm living a life of recovery. I have three beautiful young boys at home. When I was sick and my eating disorder, they said that the possibility of me having children was very, very slim. And I have three beautiful, wonderful, healthy boys. And now the blessing of it all is now I get to work alongside women and men who are struggling and boys and girls who are struggling and share my story in hopes that they don't go down the same road I did. So thank you for listening. I would love to do question and answer. Yes.
Ha, ha, ha.
Well, you just hit my hot button. She asked, you have a really tiny body. How tinier were you when you were sick? Well, there's a couple of things that I think are important for you to know. One is that for me, if you were listening to my story, for me, the eating disorder really didn't have to do with my body. I'm genetically a smaller person. That's just how I'm made. For me, it was the not eating wasn't to be small or smaller. The not eating was so that I didn't have to feel. So I think a lot of times we have a idea that people are doing it to fit our society's mold. But for me, it was just the drug. It was the pure drug of not eating so that I didn't have to have any emotions. And that, the reason I said that kind of hits my hot button is, why is it okay to say that somebody's tiny? Why is that okay? It's not okay. It's not okay to comment. I think in our society we have this thing that, like, if somebody's small, it's okay to say they're small. If somebody's obese, you wouldn't walk up to them and say, well, you're obese. How do you da-da-da-da, right? So what I'm getting at is that we've got this, it's like reverse stereotype. We have this idea that, oh, just because somebody is small, then they fit in what the norm is. But the reality is I still, just like every woman, have areas of my body that I wish were different. I still struggle with wanting to be taller. I still struggle with wanting to be bigger. And yet, that's not the body that God gave me. So I need to accept that this is the body that God gave me and be comfortable with that. And I think in our society, we could do so much better about that. We could do so much better instead of saying to somebody, oh, well, you're skinny. You know, well, what if they have an issue with being skinny? Then don't say that. You would never walk up to a fat person and say, you're fat, right? What if God made their body like that? Then that's how they're supposed to be. And the thing is what we, at the Melrose Institute, what we do is we work with people on figuring out, how is your body made? You know, where is your homeostasis weight? That means the body that you were made to be with. The unfortunate thing is a lot of people don't want to radically accept that that's where their body is. They want this ideal that we see in magazines, which, by the way, 1% of models are genetically that way. Okay, so 1% of the human population is the size of one of those runway models. So it's impossible. So instead, why don't we all work towards figuring out where can I eat in moderation and exercise in moderation, and my body will stay in the weight? And that's where the happy place is. Because I have been the same weight for 14 years, give or take 3 to 5 pounds. Now granted, I was pregnant 3 times in those years, but my body, because I was eating in moderation, exercising in moderation, and really taking good care of myself, went to where it was supposed to be. So I encourage you, I was going to show a video, but I don't have time. Next week is Eating Disorders Awareness Week, and there's a whole video, and if you go to YouTube and you search Fat Talk Free, I want you all to watch that, because it's kind of that same issue as, why do we have to talk about our bodies so much? Why do we have to talk about, oh, she's fat or he's fat or she's skinny and he's skinny? Like, why are we so focused on the banana peel? Okay? So I really encourage you to do that. And thank you. That is a very good question. I get that question all the time. But I'm not afraid to answer it because, you know, this is who I am. Any other questions? Come on. We have 5 minutes. No? Yeah?
Is there any way that kind of becoming more aware or even talking about how your own body shape can be empowering, or even having other people say, yeah, you're bigger or something, you know what I mean? Like, can that be empowering? Because I guess, like, for myself included, sometimes, like, people don't even, like, talk about what your body looks like because they're afraid.
Yeah.
Right.
I think it's when we start gaining an identity from our size, such as I'm good if I'm this, or that she's better because she's this. So when we start putting an identity to a body size, I think that's where we start getting in trouble. So if it's not going to, I don't know, it's such a fine line, because if it's not going to upset you, then yeah, but I just think there's so many other things we can talk about. Like, how come we don't in society, how come we don't walk up to each other and say, you have the most beautiful eyes? You know, why don't we ever do that? But we see each other and we're like, oh my gosh, you look so good. Have you lost weight? You know, why do we, it's kind of our cultural norm. And I've gotten in the habit over the years of not looking at people in their bodies, but looking at their eyes. And so it's amazing when you start really doing that, of looking at somebody's eyes, you can learn so much. And wow, there's so many beautiful eyes out there, beautiful colors, and that has nothing to do with weight. When you say that to somebody, wow, there's a sparkle in your eye today. That has nothing to do with whether they're skinny, whether they're larger. It has nothing to do with their body size. So I wish as a society that we could walk around and do more of that. Yeah?
When you say people get overeating disorders.
Yes.
Do they ever, like, have Thanksgiving dinner and not feel guilty?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Because remember, if it's the drug that they're needing to cope and you have other coping skills, like I eat very normally. I go out, I eat holidays, I don't think about food. And I used to know every calorie on every type of food. Now I couldn't even tell you. How does that happen? It happens because at that time, that was what I was hanging on to cope. That's what I was hanging on to in my back pocket to focus on so that I didn't have to really deal with the real stuff. So there's a 15% of people, the statistics show that 15% of people fully recover from an eating disorder. In my packet of information, there's some things that talk about this, like pieces of recovery, of having healthy relationships, having a healthy mind, things that they kind of cite as what recovery looks like. But absolutely, I mean, many people live their life without thinking about food and about what food, because, you know, food is just fuel. That's all it is. And somehow we have this idea that it's emotions, you know, that, and I always say to my patients, like, okay, when you put gas in the car, do you sit around with your girlfriends and talk about what type of gas it was? No. That's all food is putting gas in your car. When your car says it's hungry, you feed it. When it's full, you stop eating, which is called intuitive eating. And that's another piece. One key to some people's recovery is learning how to intuitively eat again. Learning how to know, oh, I need to eat right now, or I need to stop right now. And in our society in America, we have that all confused. We have portion sizes confused. We have being able to say my stomach is full, that confused. So, but it's a journey. It's not like, you know, I didn't get there overnight. I would say my intuitive eating has really been in the last, since my oldest son was born, probably the last 10 years. I'd say the first 5 years of my recovery were really, oh my gosh, can I eat that? You know, what's that going to happen? But the more I learned to trust my body and to trust that food was just fuel, I realized, oh, life has so much more. I have so much more room in my brain now without thinking about food. You know, there's so much more in there to use my creativity and to be the person that I was created to be when I'm not thinking about that kind of stuff. So, but you have to kind of remember, though, that it's a coping skill. It's a drug. Many people live their life without drinking alcohol again that were alcoholics, and many people live their life without taking drugs again. It's very similar to that. And the brain chemistry can change. I just want to thank you for coming out and for your questions. And if you have any other questions, I'll be up here for a few more minutes. And have a great day.